Welcome to the IF podcast. My name is Natalie Hopkinson. I'm a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation, and joining me in the studio are Jeff Prudhomme, fellow and vice president of the Interactivity Foundation.
Great to be here.
And Sue Goodney-Lee, fellow and education coordinator for the Interactivity Foundation.
Hi there.
Today we'll talk about two topics, the state of public debate in Wisconsin and the future of K-12 education. So, Jeff, what has been going on in Wisconsin?
What was really interesting is in the midst of these democratic uprisings in the Middle East, you all of a sudden had one in our Midwest where you had our governor who came in upon his inauguration and made some pretty striking moves to restrict collective bargaining rights for public sector employees in the state of Wisconsin. And I think where we started noticing that is just the massive amounts of people who started coming out into the streets to, and especially thronging into the Capitol to protest this move by the governor. And then part of what was happening in those rallies and marches in the Capitol were a lot of discussions going on about, you know, policy, about that policy, but also about, you know, becoming an engaged citizen.
It keeps getting bigger and bigger every day. He needs to back down. What we're seeing now are even more private sector workers showing up because they know this is an assault on all workers. This is not just an assault.
Particularly
on people
for people outside of government, they look at this and say, this is a pretty good deal. The truth is we don't have money to offer. And if you're going to negotiate, you got to have something to offer.
If they can do it to people in Wisconsin with its historic working class roots, it can be done anywhere.
We have several fellows in Wisconsin, along with a bunch of facilitators. We've trained about a dozen facilitators there now. And apparently there was discussions of IF reports that happened within the protests
in the Capitol
area,
building.
In the Capitol building, because, you know, people were sort of trying to make sense of everything. And, you know, one of the misnomers that seems to have been floating about is that only people who had a stake were involved. And it sounds like actually there were a lot of other people that were involved, and that there was some interest in, a lot of interest in, you know, not just wanting to be there and have a presence, but in wanting to understand this and how does this connect to other issues and the breadth and broad nature of IF reports, you know, I think kind of lent itself in a helpful way to, you know, making sense of those things. Because, you know, a lot of our reports, you know, they explore an area, but they explore broad conceptual policies, you know, policy ideas. And so they're not partisan. They're not, you know, taking things in a particular angle. The policies aren't real narrow. So often they potentially float across different areas of concern. So It was interesting to hear that, you know, several of them were getting discussed in there. Everything from democratic nation building to regulation, work. But, you know, you think democratic nation building, you know, why would they care about that in Wisconsin in the middle of all this? Well, you know, with everything that was going on in other parts of the world,
that's right.
It became, oh, hey, there's a synergy here.
Well, yeah, yeah. I thought that was the most wonderful thing about, in Tahrir Square in Cairo, they had signs supporting the Wisconsin protesters and supporting their effort. And You too can get your rights like us. And so it really makes me think about the debate between the governor and this legislator and the unions in Wisconsin. It really ended up reaching a real crisis point. Well, we'll see how it gets resolved in the courts and everything, but It was almost too late in the process for them to really begin some really fundamental discussions around what's happening. The Republicans did have a majority. They were fully within the legal framework. It was perfectly legal what they were doing to strip away whatever rights that they wanted to strip away. And, you know, why did it get to the point where you did have a majority of people that were so far outside of what all those protesters, like, where did that disconnect start and why did it take so long for it to sort of come to a head?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because you could say that was part of their democratic process, that the people of Wisconsin chose this particular policy course that the governor was enacting in the name of the popular will. But I think what it brings to mind is that our democracy is so much messier than that. Elections are never just about one thing. And the reasons that people get elected are often, you know, about emotional issues or group issues, as well as clearly thought out, you know, rational policy choices. And I think part of what happens with the kinds of discussions we have is that people get to explore all those different aspects that go into our democracy or all those different things that go into our policy choices, that they're not just rational decisions. We make decisions that are emotional mm-hmm. or, you know, part of our group identity that have nothing to do with, you know, clearly thought out economic goals or policy goals we might have.
All right. And this is Natalie. And those who aren't familiar with IF, we are a nonprofit that exists to explore issues related to public policy. And we provide forums all around the country. We provide discussion materials and discussion reports where people can get involved in discussing issues that are related to the public decisions that we make as a society. So in a very perverse way, Wisconsin was really great for IF because it did show why these things matter and why it's worth spending your time talking about them before they reach a critical stage. And, you know, public policy is not just about politics. I mean, these are real things that have a real impact on people. And, you know, sometimes it takes these sort of catastrophic events to happen so that people wake up a little bit and say, look, if we don't want to have a steamroller come over us, then we might want to pay attention right. to what's going on right. and really think about it in a really deep, substantive way, you know, before it's too late.
This is Sue. You know, it's interesting. There's a couple key aspects of our process are, you know, one that we focus on having citizens discuss. But another big one is that we focus on contrasting possibilities. And that makes us really unusual in terms of this sort of policy discussion. And I think the benefit is that it, you know, helps to elucidate a whole range of possibilities for folks to explore and consider the consequences. So, you know, if you're really fully doing that, then you have a chance to realize, you know, you get past the, you know, maybe identity politics and right. into,
exactly.
okay, well, what's, you know, if we did this, what would happen? And, you know, I was listening to NPR this morning, for instance, and they're saying, well, basically the budget impasse has come down to environmental issues and the issue of Planned Parenthood. You know, and so it's like, well, these obviously have lots of politics behind them. Mm-hmm. You know, is anyone sitting down and really exploring the ramifications of Planned Parenthood, for instance? A lot of the concern is abortion. All right, well, you know, there is no federal funding of abortion.
That's
but,
right.
you know, there's still this, well, we just have to, there should be no federal money at all. Okay, well, then the impact happens that, you know, we adopted a little boy a year and a half ago. He had all kinds of issues because his mother never got prenatal care. She mm-hmm. was very poor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I don't know that she even realized that Planned Parenthood offers this because there's so much just
oh my God.
Ideological yeah. friction.
There you know? Really is. And the thing is, Planned Parenthood really, in some ways, it's a safety net for some people. And so, and then the other thing to get on, you know, I live here in Washington, D.C., and I've done a lot of my graduate work was on D.C. and looking at its history and the sort of colonial structure. And, you know, it's really interesting to me how D.C. always ends up being this political football. I mean, we're just this little city.
Right.
We have enough dysfunction on our own local level because our budget is tied to the federal government's budget. If they feel like on a whim, they just don't want to allow us to spend our own money, then they can't. If it's sort of about exploring public policies before you reach a crisis stage.
Right.
If we would just really sort of clarify what our values, what our priorities are, it should never get to this point of dysfunction where you have mm-hmm. 100,000 people
right.
in the state capital.
The point about DC, and it also connects to Wisconsin, that people need a sense of efficacy, that their voice matters or that they have some say in things. And DC is a perfect example where, like you're saying, it's a political football, that there's so much that happens with the budget for DC or the services that people might have in DC that depends on the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't have full representation
that's
really
right.
at all. So there's that sense of efficacy that's lacking. And I think the same thing in Wisconsin that when, and this, I'm not arguing the merits of the case, but simply, you know, for the collective bargaining rights to be taken out for public service unions in Wisconsin, that was all of a sense of, you know, a loss of efficacy or a loss of, you know, your ability to control or have a say in your political life that drew people out. So I think that those are things that are important to people and that can, you know, losing that sense of efficacy can either bring people out into the streets or it can just disenfranchise people or turn people off and say, you know, well, politics really isn't you know, for me, it's political discourse doesn't get anything done. So why even bother?
Mm-hmm. I hear people say all the time, like, they just don't get it. You know, like, don't they live normal lives? Don't they, you know, pay mortgages? Don't they have, like, there's a lot more complexity to so many issues. And, you know, if the policymakers are just going by, you know, ideological politics or, you know, people that have money, you know, the big money that are funding their next election or whatever, everything's just a bargaining chip. You know, like, well, no, this has real implications. You know, it's not as simple. For instance, you know, the Planned Parenthood example, again, it's not just, oh, well, they fund abortions. Well, no, you know, like in our case, the birth mother of my child wanted to have her child, you know, didn't want to have an abortion.
That's
and
right.
Couldn't get prenatal care.
That's right.
You know, where is she supposed to go? If you shut that down for, you know, say the whole district, well, it's close to Maryland and Virginia, people can go. Maryland might as well be on the moon if you live in D.C. I just drove here from there and it was far.
And that's what I was about to say about Planned Parenthood. I personally have family members here in D.C. who have gotten basic services. I mean, like, where else are you going to go other than that? And so if you remove that safety net for people, I mean, that's something that you really have to think about when you're making these decisions. And sometimes explaining to children, like, what the differences are between the quote unquote left and the right and the blue and the red. And they came to one of our citizen discussions that IF sponsors last weekend. So we stopped in for a minute. And so my kids are 10 and 7, and we were discussing a property report, and I was explaining. And so we're sort of tying what we were talking about in the property report to what's going on in the news and this debate between the Republicans and the Democrats. And so, you know, I explained to them, I said, you know, it really is a fight over property and who owns it, who has the right. If you're somebody who is vulnerable and doesn't have access to basic gynecological care, you have a need. But then, you know, then I explained to them, okay, well, but what if you're the millionaire and they want to take 60% of your money? You have $1 million and the government wants to take 600,000 of it. You know, what are you going to do? So, you know, my daughter says, oh, well, you have to give it to the person who needs the help. You know, my son was like, oh, they're not taking my money. I think once you sort of begin to understand it and trying to sympathize with both sides, it really could help you make these sort of compromises that need to be made in order to keep the freaking trash picked up. That's
all I'm thinking about. Trash, pick up my trash. Indoor plumbing. It's really what our civilization comes down to.
Yes. Jeff, were you going to say
something?
Well,
I was just going to talk about this notion of the government shutdown, that some of what it brings up is this idea that our democratic society is not just about what the government does. And I think that's a real important thing that people get out of our projects, that when they are deliberating about these different possibilities, they are, in a sense, being part of our governance. And they're exploring different ways we could do things as a society. And often the ideas they'll come up with don't necessarily have to do with what the quote unquote government would do, but what citizens might do. So I think that's like a real exciting part of this, that people realize that, I mean, we often think, well, okay, we need to the government to do these minimal things, and we have this minimal interaction with them where we vote and we pay taxes, but then that's about it. But that's a pretty minimal idea of citizenship. And I think what people really want is the chance for it to be more, to have more of a role. And so engaging in this kind of a project helps them do that. And a lot of the ideas they come up with are about doing that.
And also sort of staying in tuned, and, you know, you sort of become more aware of different public policies that are being debated in a range of areas of interest. You know, I guess the hope is that we're sort of reawakening or providing a vehicle for people to have their awareness increased and their levels of engagement increased in public policy. Our next topic is the future of K-12 education. We have just published a guide for public discussion edited by an Interactivity Foundation fellow, Adolf Gunderson, and it's a guide for public discussion. If you're interested, please download it at our website at interactivityfoundation.org.
Good morning, class.
Good morning, Ms. Trump.
For more than a decade, the state has been under court order to provide extra funding for low-income school districts. Now some state legislators say
it's reasonable to think about eliminating half the achievement gap at the kindergarten door.
Hi, guys. How are you today?
just woke up from a nap.
You just woke up from your nap. I know that.
In California, schools consistently rank in the bottom third among states, and one of every four students drops out.
Sand.
Forward.
The teacher teaches, the students repeat, and even the principal.
You all are both parents, and what is the level of debate around education that you're finding?
The report that just got released went through a variety of iterations, and one thing we did a few months ago is several of us ran public discussions on, you know, some of the ideas in there. And I did mine with a group of moms in my community, and one of whom was a teacher. A couple had been involved in education at various points. And it was really interesting to listen to them. And one of the big issues that kept coming up was the idea that you can't just throw money at the problem. You know, and one mom who was teaching in rather an underfunded school, but in a very wealthy county, and many of the moms at the table that were from that county were like, really? They don't have Kleenex and they have to share books here? And like, yeah, you know, they've consolidated the poorer kids here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's not the same kinds of resources. But what they also lack is, you know, the parents, you know, in some of the other schools in the county will fight to be able to come in and help out at the school and bring resources and bring stuff, you know. And so if you have places where, you know, parents are working three jobs or, you know, are busy with other stuff, it makes it really hard to balance things, you know, even if the money is somewhat equal.
This is Jeff. I was just going to say about the education discussion, so much of what we hear in the news is just about test scores, or, you know, there's recent controversy about whether or not there was cheating on some of these high-stake tests at a DC school. And we have a lot of policy decisions that are floated by, you know, almost by slogan, you know, that we've got to, you know, corporatize education, that will be the key, or, you know, testing will be the key, and accountability and things like that. But not a lot of, you know, deep reflection about, well, what do we really want? What do we want as parents? What do we want as, you know, fellow citizens? So, you know, we talk about children being the future. So what kind of future do we want? And I heard an interesting discussion recently about how this current accountability approach, which is focusing a lot on standardized testing, is pushing art and music and PE and things like that out of a lot of schools, a lot of public schools especially. And yet these are the kinds of activities that can foster more, you know, creative, open-ended thinking where, you know, there is no one right answer. So, you know, people have to find novel solutions. Well, that's what we're going to be needing more and more in the future, are people that can grow up and think out of the box or come up with a new solution, not, you know, follow directions and fill in the right bubble. So are we educating for the kind of future that we really want?
I became a parent when No Child Left Behind really sort of began. And to me, that again is another example of how public policy can completely set the direction of everyone's thinking about a topic. You know, No Child Left Behind was based on, the idea was that everyone would become 100% proficient in every subject area in the country. And so they had a systems of testings and checks, and it's a very complicated sort of system. Each state is sort of specialized, and they could decide how they can structure how they're going to get there to where everyone is 100% proficient. Mm-hmm. And without really thinking a lot about, well, what does that mean? If everybody's 100% proficient, to me, that says you have like a bunch of little robots who can, you know, who can bubble in on demand. And, you know, what does that say about the sort of creativity and the innovation that our economy really needs? There's going to be a limited amount of jobs at Walmart. But the next Google, it's like infinite. You know, it's really the possibilities for where we can go as a society in this country and all around the world, you know, as we grow. I mean, all the growth is in technology, science, creativity. I'm currently conducting a project for IF on the arts and society. So we talk about this a lot, where the entertainment industry is America's largest export right now. And so, you know, you think about well, what is going to be the result in 20 years from now when you see the legacy of this public policy? Like, where's the next John Coltrane going to come from?
The tension hall.
Maybe so.
There's still always going to be kids that, no matter how much you try to make them color in the lines, they're just not going to. But they're going to pay for it under the system. You know, you're not sitting down and taking the test. That's what's wrong with you?
Right.
And, you know, it's been interesting because I've actually been hearing a lot more people talking about homeschooling. And, you know, that because especially those with boys that, you know, don't conform to, you know, the expectation, sit still, pay attention, you know, this sort of thing, that the school system is like, you know, there's 25, 30 kids in this classroom. Mm-hmm. Your kid is just too rambunctious. Mm-hmm. Get him out of here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and they just keep getting in trouble. And so parents that have the wherewithal seem to be looking more to, okay, how can I homeschool this child? And are creating, you know, some co-ops and other sorts of situations to make it easier, since nobody knows, you know, all the stuff you need to homeschool a child. But, well, apparently the standards vary substantially across state line, but it's, but a lot of people are finding ways to do that.
Oh, I think about it all the time.
Kid's a year and a half and I'm starting to think about it now.
I think you might have been the tipping point for me on that. We were driving back from one of our fellows meetings and we sort of talked about it. And I have a few friends who are homeschooling now and they all have boys, mm-hmm. and they all have this situation. They're like, there's a sort of idea of how can all of our boys be wrong? Mm-hmm. Like, how could there be something wrong with them? Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's this whole like, if you don't sit down and do the worksheet and follow directions, right, then there's something wrong, right, or maybe they need to be medicated, or maybe they need to this, you know, they're just not falling in line. And I think that it's, you know, not only is there anxiety on the students, there's a lot of anxiety on the teachers because, mm-hmm. ooh, half your class is failing.
You're being measured by this.
Yes, and you are. And so to me, this is where this sort of corporate approach ends up trickling down. What is the quickest way to get from basic to advanced? Mm. Oh, we think we need to hold Timmy back, or, you know, we're thinking, right, you know, we need to label them as special ed so that we can get them off our books. You know, do you do anything to sort of cream? And, you know, here in DC too, I've talked to many, many parents over the years, because this is all of our obsession. And, you know, I know people who have like the super duper high performing schools in DC, and they say it, they teach to the top of the test. And if your kid can't get there, and the same thing in very wealthy parts of DC and Bethesda, they teach to the top of the test. If your kid can't get there, then they will push them out.
Yep.
Either by alienating you as a parent or trying to track them to the short bus.
Well, I was surprised to find out, you know, because I mean, we just adopted our son about a year and a half ago, and, you know, we didn't know anything about this. And as we got more involved, we realized, you know, look at some of these kids that were 4 going into school, and I'm like, they could spell all kinds of words. What the heck is wrong? Like, why are they spelling? You know, and so, and they're not, you know, like the exception. They're kind of more the rule. And parents have informed me that, oh yeah, no, they expect once you go to school, they're basically teaching at least a year above the level.
Right.
So, you know, really your kid needs to have to, you know, come in recognizing letters, recognizing numbers, you know, doing all these things. But even if, you know, my child can count to 4 already, I'm like, great. But I can tell already he's this just mischievous, I'm going to mess with you, I'm really bright, and he's not, oh, he'll be a disaster at a school. That's why I'm starting to look at it now, because I'm like, this is going to go badly.
Well, he'll be a disaster in a certain kind of school, and that's the thing, and that's a big part of the discussion that we want people to have, is really, what are their different visions of what a school could be? That's so much of our approach, is to get people to explore what are the different goals we have that we could have as a society, instead of just thinking there's this one choice or this one model, you know, in this case, one model of schooling. And you know you've got a problem when, you know, if you take a basic condition like boyness, you know, being a boy, and basically pathologize that, or, you know, anytime there's that kind of a big mismatch on a large scale, it's telling you there's something wrong with our thinking or the model that we're using, you know?
Right.
And that's going on with our schools. Like, there's a way we talk about it that in the official discourse, we want these test results. But, you know, when it comes down to it, is it really what we want for our kids, or is it really what all of us want? Maybe some people do want that. But I think, you know, a lot of the parents that I know, you know, couldn't care less about the test scores in the school. They want to know Like, is it a teacher that's responding to my child as an individual? Is my child getting a chance to, you know, grow in new ways or try new things? And then, you know, they're happy with that.
But they're, they might be the rare parent that has the time to sort of reflect and really not be swayed by the madness that are going on. I think the reality is a lot of people are so busy and they're, you know, they're at work and they really don't have time to sort of think about it and to really figure out how we can gauge and how we can, you know, maintain our sort of our own value system. And I think this is just as a another broader look at what if and what if does is that I think that because our society is moving so fast and, you know, and Sue, we recently finished a video that talked about our activities and Sue talked about it on camera about how we're basically teaching like it's 1950, right? So we've got this lecture approach to everything. There's this lecture approach to things. And I think you said, you know, kids have more information on their phone than they have like in this library.
They sit there on the phone, you know, when you're lecturing and they're like, yeah, according to my, you know, blah, blah, blah site, that's not correct.
Right.
So you do have,
I think that maybe that's where No Child Left Behind is. There is this sense that the Obama administration has signaled that they're going to be retreating from No Child Left Behind. And, but I, what I do hope is that as opposed to just swinging in the opposite direction, we really start using it as an opportunity to really, really critically think about what are our values? Something isn't right and we have to have some sort of change, but how we get to that change and what is the best way, that the most futuristic forward thinking way to do that, it's not really clear. And sometimes it's not clear in the academy, it's not clear in think tank world, it's not clear in a lot of ways. So a lot of what we're doing with this report is trying to provide sort of a baseline for people to talk about. Maybe we can sort of come to some answers on our own.
But I think one thing that makes our process, you know, kind of different, as Jeff pointed out earlier, is that we try to get folks to look beyond just the government as policymaker. You know, because really, I mean, in just this discussion, well, you could have students interacting in different ways with teachers. You could have, you know, maybe different kinds of schools set up in a community so that it really meets more of the goals of that community. You could have networks of homeschoolers. You know, there's a lot of different things that you might think of as, you know, I mean, those are kind of specific, but, you know, broad policy approach being, you know, what are other nexi by which changes in the education system might come about that might be community-based or, you know, parent-based or child-based.
And all of those are in the report. And I really would recommend that everyone download the report. It's at interactivityfoundation.org. And it's got a cool, snazzy design by Kalita. Kalita Rawls is an artist out of LA who has designed it to look like an actual composition book that kids still use in school. But this is one for grownups to be able to download it, get a group of people together, and be able to discuss some of these issues.
For those of you that are in the DC, Baltimore area, I'm actually starting a new project on childhood. We look for some of our projects to kind of relate so that maybe it could be a discussion series. And so, you know, we're going to think about, you know, sort of what Jeff was talking about earlier, you know, what does childhood look like? What might we want it to look like? You know, in these sorts of broader questions. So this is Sue Goodney-Lee. My contact information is on the site. If you are in the area, I'm, you know, putting a panel together. This is for a year-long sanctuary panel, which is a really interesting experience. So get in touch with me.
And if you have any feedback in general, you can email ifpodcast@gmail.com.
This is Jeff. I wanted to bring up a point about with this education discussion that relates to the spirit of the kinds of projects we do and the way people engage, especially when we're talking about our own kids. People often get very competitive and you like you almost think at some in some communities people are probably timing conception for openings in certain
preschools
and
Manhattan.
And what I'm trying to get at is that there's this sense of competition and really kind of a model of poverty or deprivation that we all have to fight. You know, it's like nature, tooth and claw. We've got to fight for our own and for our kids to give them this competitive advantage and kind of, you know, hit the other person before they hit you. And we carry that over into our thinking about education. There's this sense of competition mm-hmm. of where you're going to get your kid in, and the schools are competing with each other. And just as a contrast to that, like, our discussions basically operate out of a model of generosity mm-hmm. And abundance. I would say, like, a key theme for us is generosity of spirit. And that's the way people engage in our discussions. Mm-hmm. And you would be so surprised at how people just open up and change the way they interact with each other when mm-hmm. they're thinking about whatever the topic is. Mm-hmm. It can be something that they feel very passionately about, and they will come in feeling like they've got a point to make and they've got a point to defeat. Mm-hmm. And eventually, you know, they may start out that way, but I would say after a couple of sessions, they are so open, recognizing that we're exploring possibilities together, they become open to those other points of view. And it really becomes not a competitive discussion mm-hmm. where you've got to close down the other points of view, but really a generous discussion where you're trying to open up the possibilities for exploration. And so, you know, I almost wonder if discussing education in that way, in that spirit, would help kind of reinvigorate this sense of generosity in our overall view of mm-hmm. education, instead of always seeing it as this, you know, one-upsmanship.
This is Sue, you know, kind of playing, you know, further on what Jeff was saying. You know, I think one of the things that our process does is that we often will recruit for different points of view and different political perspective, you know, just different life experience. But when we get everyone there in the room, the goal then becomes, you know, to create this connection. You know, many people want the best for their kid, mm-hmm. but they don't then extend that to, you know, wanting the best for everyone's kid.
That's right.
And
right.
So, you know, what we do is we start with elucidating common concerns. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that kind of puts everyone on the same page, like, oh, well, yeah, you know, I totally disagree with how you see the world, but I share that concern. Right. You know, and here's how I see it, and here's how I see it. And the other genius thing that our founder did was he has, you know, we need to have these folks share a meal. Mm-hmm. So every time they meet, they share a meal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think we forget about these sort of basic civilities in the yes. society these days.
Yes.
But like that does a huge amount to build that camaraderie right. and that connection. And it's a lot harder to start swearing at the person or, you know, get, and obviously
you
a facilitator
to
ameliorate this. But, you know, like people right. don't really even want to do that anymore yeah. because right. they feel like, oh, well, you know, I'm sharing a meal with you. I've gotten to know you. You know,
right.
you see people that you would never, they would never talk in the real world.
That's right.
And they go walking out to the cars together and they're still talking. And, you know, and it's a really neat, you know, kind of crossover effect that people get a chance to, you know, at the end of the day, they see beyond each other, you know, the politics to, okay, yeah, you know, we hear about the same kind of thing. I still don't know that I agree with how you think about it. But I understand how you think about
right.
it now. And it's that makes
more,
a huge difference.
If you think of it, it's more, it's not exactly, but it's more like a kitchen table kind of conversation mm-hmm. as opposed to, you know, when people hear about what we do, a lot of times they'll think, oh, it's like a public forum or mm-hmm. a town hall meeting.
Right,
well,
right.
we all, you know, heard about how these town hall meetings went where there's a speaker
right.
up front and other people in the audience trying to shout them down. Well, no one's shouting at these meetings, you're sitting around a table mm-hmm, exploring mm-hmm. ideas together. And when people come together like that and interact over this extended period of time, really going into, you know, what are all the issues here? What are some different perspectives on it? What are some different visions of the future that different people might have? Not, you know, not just my own hopes and dreams, but, you know, those of the people down the street or in a totally different part of town. And you do that over all these months, there's a real camaraderie that develops in the mm-hmm. group. You know, people that didn't know each other at first end up really feeling connected.
Yeah, I had a public discussion on civil rights, and this one guy, you know, they were both in the computer realm, both participants, but the one guy was this, you know, large African-American guy from the South, and he had very particular ideas about, you know, civil rights and when can we get rid of civil rights protections and affirmative action. And, you know, he just had some very strong ideas. And this other guy, you know, smaller white guy, pretty conservative, had some very different ideas, also very firm. And by the end, it was interesting because, you know, I think they each kind of had reevaluated how they were thinking about this issue. But, you know, the bigger thing was that they were able to relate better to this other person, mm-hmm. you know, and it wasn't just, you know, some object that they were related, you know, it was like a real person. And, oh, well, yeah, you know, I could see where that's true. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when the discussion ended, they talked for another hour, even though they both had to get up really early the next day. And I think they even kept in touch after. Like, they just really, you know, kind of forged a connection. So, you know, certainly the sanctuary discussions, people interact you know, more than a year. But even the public discussions, people that would normally not ever sit down and break bread together, you know, decide, oh, well, you're not so strange after all.
IF is a small foundation, and we have about 8 fellows, and then there are many facilitators that have been trained around the country that facilitate IF-style discussions. And so we can't reach everyone, but those who are really interested in this sort of conversation and really exploring public policy in a supportive, warm environment, civil environment, please reach out to us. And we have our website is interactivityfoundation.org. You can also email us at ifpodcast@gmail.com with your comments. I'm Natalie Hopkinson, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation. And joining me in the studio today has been Sue Goodney Lee, a fellow with the Interactivity Foundation, and Jeff Prudhomme, also with the Interactivity Foundation.